dad's boat was attacked by pirates. Someone got shot and he died. Like, motors broke down and, like, motors had to be changed during, like in the middle of the ocean. Like, crazy things like that. Wow. And I'm just like, oh, cool. What's the hardest thing I've done? I lost MasterChef twice.
Calm down.
Real, they were big events though. Let's not diminish that.
Yeah, but it's not the same as like, oh, changing a propeller when there's sharks around you. Like, that's frightening.
Literally,
like,
pirates ransacking the boat.
Yeah.
Life gives you two choices when it throws everything at you. You can let it swallow you whole, or you take those lemons. And as the old saying goes, you turn it into sweet, delicious lemonade. And that's exactly what this podcast is all about. Welcome to Lemonade. I'm your host, Elizabeth O'Neill, and I'll be sharing the incredible stories from inspiring people who've turned the hardest times in their life, their lemons, into lemonade. Because let's be real, we all want to know how they did it, the lessons they learnt, and what life is like sipping limoncello on the other side. Let's get juicing.
You probably know Khan Ong as one of MasterChef's most beloved contestants across the entire series. I've known Khan for a little over a decade, and in that time, I've watched him flourish from a fresh-faced 19-year-old to now an incredible cook, television personality, author, restaurant owner, and a staunch advocate for the LGBTQI+ community. But life hasn't always been easy, despite what his glittering Instagram aesthetic and infectious smile will have you believe. Born in a refugee camp in Indonesia, encountering racism and bullying when settling in Australia, realising he was gay and coming out to the world, the untimely death of his father to liver cancer, and his subsequent mental breakdown. Khan's story is a testament to the fact that life can throw you many, many lemons, but it's what you do with them that ultimately shape who you are as a person. This is honestly one of my favourite Lemonade episodes, partly because it's unlike any I've ever done. And if you're an avid listener, you'll know exactly what I mean as soon as it begins. It's free-flowing and hilarious, but also gets really deep and profound in parts. Just like my friendship with Khan, really. I've split this into two eps. Part two will drop on Wednesday. For now, enjoy part one. I know I certainly did. Oh, and a content warning with this one if you've got little ears around. Here's Khan. Khan Ong, welcome to the Lemonade Podcast. We are recording from your bed, and it is literally the softest bed I've ever sat on.
It's so funny that, like, for the first 5 minutes, you're like, your bed is just so soft.
I don't understand how you've made. I said to him, this bed is really soft, and he said, yeah, it's great, but you get a really sore back, and I feel like that's not great.
No, it's not great. Especially, so I had a friend over the other day, and then in the morning he was just laying on the ground. I was like, what's wrong? He goes, your bed is so soft that my back hurts.
Yeah, I really feel like it's not great, but gosh, this is literally the most comfortable I've ever been recording a podcast, so thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. I forgot to book my own house, so we've got Diana filming a TV show in the front room right now, so we're just kind of locked away in my room.
Yes. Khan's housemate is Diana Chan, who was the former winner from a couple of years ago of MasterChef, so yeah, there's always something happening in this house. There's always some kind of recording, and he calls me the other day, and he's like, I forgot to book the house, so yeah, we're going to have to lock ourselves in the bedroom.
Which is a ridiculous thing to say, but we've got like a whiteboard system where we kind of just write in when we need the house for what, and neither of us did it because we didn't think that during this season that we would be doing much.
Yeah, well, totally. And it is Christmas week. How are you feeling?
Calm. Very calm.
Really?
Well, I got all my Christmas...
You're the only person that says that.
Well, I got all my Christmas shopping done online, so it's just all coming. And yeah. I was like, I bought it like a week ago, so there was like 18 days for it to arrive. And I was like, yeah, I'm great.
Yeah, lovely. And you always cook beautiful food on Christmas Day. Like, your family doesn't really celebrate it, but you would just love eating the beautiful food part of it.
Yeah, definitely. So it's actually Christmas Eve that we celebrate-ish. We always have a little barbecue together, and then whatever's left over becomes like our Christmas lunch. But it's always a barbecue to start.
Oh my God, it's always epic as well. I'm always really jealous, and I look at, like, I always have beautiful food on Christmas Day, but then you put up your videos and I'm like, are.
No, it's actually nothing ever, nothing glam. It's always mum like, here's three proteins, we're putting it on the barbie, you make the salads, you make the sauces, you make the dips. And I'm like, okay, so what have you done?
Yes, exactly. And I feel like that always happens with Khan whenever we organise dinner parties. We're like, okay, cool, Leah, let's all get up. Let's all catch up for dinner. And you'll be like, okay, what can I bring? We're like, can you just do the mains and the desserts and the sides?
No, but like literally, but it's fun. Like I really enjoy it. I enjoy going to like people's houses and actually cooking for them as well. Like one of my friends was hungover on the weekend and I was like, oh, we're supposed to be having dinner. And she's like, what do you want to do? I was like, can I just cook? And she's like, yeah, come around, cook.
Yeah. So you were at my house the other week and we were hungover and you just cooked like gourmet pasta for us for lunch. I'm like, this is the most fancy lunch I've ever had.
No, she's lying. The pasta was not gourmet at all. Like I literally just found random ingredients in her fridge. I was like, oh yeah, chili. There's no cream. So I'll just use like yogurt. And I was like, let's just make this happen.
I don't understand how you did though, because it tasted delicious and there was nothing that I would have resembled in my fridge to be able to make that pasta. So there you go. Now, Khan, with all of my interviews, I start them the same way, and that is wanting to know what childhood was like for my guests. You had a very interesting childhood. Can you take me right back? What was it like for you?
Okay, so I don't remember this part, but I was born in an immigration camp / refugee camp in Indonesia. I came over to Australia when I was two, so mum and dad were actually there for 4 years. And I think it's a little bit different to what you think of when you think refugee camps here now. Back then, you kind of just lived on an island. Oh. And then, like, everyone had jobs and everyone was still working and, like, people were still making money. It's really strange. So, like, she was mum was, like, a seamstress there and dad chopped trees for the government for wood. So it was, like, they were making money and that's kind of how they could get to Australia. You pay like your processing fee of your paperwork and things like that. So you needed a couple of $1,000 to do so. So it took them a couple of years to do it because it was like each person had to pay like $3,000 or $4,000.
Oh my God.
And back then it was like, that's big money. Yeah, so I came over. Mum and dad lived with an uncle and auntie for a while. They started a business when I was 12. So that became like epic because it meant that we weren't spending that much time together because they were really hard workers. So it was like, it's open 7 days a week. Mum still has one of them now and still open 7 days a week. So they've always been really hard workers. So for me, I spent a lot of time with them in the kitchen at night. That's kind of when Mum would make Dad and the family dinner. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember, you said you were born in this camp. Do you have any memories of that whatsoever or was it just a little bit too young?
Coke bottles and snakes.
What does that mean?
I remember loving, like, lugging around a bottle of Coke, but, like, a 2-litre bottle of Coke, and I'm, like, one. Like, so I was, like, I literally was lugging around and pulling it after me. And I remember snakes, really weirdly, I remember snakes. And
Real snakes, so we're not talking about lolly snakes.
No, like, real snakes, and I didn't understand why, and then later on Mum goes, oh, Dad used to, like, when he was chopping wood, he would find snakes, so at one stage he got really okay with dealing with them, so he became the island snake catcher. And so there were always snakes in the house. I was like, what do you mean? Like, could I have died? And she goes, no, they were in, like, little, like, wooden crates and things. I'm like, that felt like I could still have died.
When I picture wooden crate, I picture a lot of holes and gaps.
Well, that's what I mean. They were, like, kind of baskets because they were, like, wooden, but, like, woven wood. I don't know. Like, they were, like, rattan, basically.
I think I know. Yeah, kind of like a woven. I know what you mean. So then you came over to Australia when you were young. Do you remember what it was like settling into Australia or is there any vivid memories around that?
This is a really sad memory, even though, like, I'm not sad about it, but just the thought of it is sad, is that Mum used to walk me to kindergarten and primary school, and then, like, I'm talking, like, cold days, windy days, rainy days. I just remember that, and I was just kind of like, she's done a lot. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like little things like that actually is so much love, because now I'm like, I'm not going out in the rain. Like, I don't care what the occasion is. I'm not going out in the rain. And Mum was, like, walking me to and from kindergarten and school in the rain. I'm like, yeah, so that's kind of my most vivid memory of being a child. And then
Yeah, I don't really remember much until my sister was born. So that was when I was in like year five or year four. Yeah, no, actually, that's a lie. Year two. Mm-hmm. Year two, my sister was born. And we moved houses. The business was in its first or second year, which is ridiculous because I'm like, why would you choose to start a business and then have a baby?
So true.
Like, it's ridiculous. Like, I'm like, you're crazy. But Amy's great. Like, from the point of her being born, we were kind of really close. We actually got matching tattoos yesterday.
Oh my gosh, cute. Yeah, I did notice you went there and it's the one place no one can get into, but obviously you can.
Oh, I've been friends with the tattoo artist for years. Like, it's not a MasterChef thing. It's not like, hey, I cook you things and you give me a tattoo. It's like, I literally just text him like, hey, can you just fit me in anywhere? And he's like, yeah, God. Yeah.
It's a really nice tattoo as well.
Yeah, it's cute. It's like, it's two people pinky promising. But just side note on this story, one of my really close friends has the same tattoo with his best friend at the time. So Luke has this tattoo.
Oh.
And so I had to text him yesterday and be like, my sister really wants this tattoo. Are you okay with it? And he's like, oh, yeah, go. No issues.
It's really sweet. I love it. Oh, very nice. Well, that was a lovely segue about your sister because you just said how close you've been since she was born. And then you said you got a tattoo yesterday. Yeah. So that's so lovely.
Yeah, but I think that she's actually like really manipulative. And the reason that we got a tattoo together is because she knew that Mum would kill her if she got any other tattoo. But because her first tattoo would be with me, Mum would be like, yeah, that's fine. And then she can slowly get more tattoos.
Eventually, next minute, her whole body is covered in tattoos. How do you think those formative years and coming over to Australia and I guess watching your parents work so hard since you can remember shaped who you are today?
Okay, so life when we were young was harder than I thought it was. Like, thinking back now, like when you're a child and when you're a teenager, you don't really think that like life sucks.
You don't know any better.
You don't really know anything. Mm. You're just like, yeah, this is what normal life is.
Yep.
But now looking back, I'm like, there were days where we literally had like rice, soy sauce and onion omelets. And onion omelets are currently like, they've been my favorite thing for like years now. Like, I just obsessed with them. And I remember at one point we stopped eating them. And I asked Mum about it recently. I was like, how come you stopped making that dish? She goes, because we had more money. Like, we were able to actually buy things that didn't cost us $4.
Yeah.
Like, dinner was so simple back then. But it's those kind of foods that I still have a really great connection with, like congee. Yeah, literally this onion. The onion omelet is literally sliced onions in a pan, caramelized, then you crack eggs into it, and then you mix it, and then you serve it with rice. Like, it's the most...
That's yum.
It's so yum, though. It's so yum. Yeah, and knowing that my parents worked so hard, I think that's kind of pushed my work ethic. I work. Like, I enjoy working. I take on way too much. So much so that both my business partner and my manager literally are like, you need to take a day or two off to just get your brain back together because you're going psychotic, which is fine. But I enjoy it. I really enjoy. I feel as though when I'm not working that I'm not doing anything and that I'm not, I don't know. It's this like inner thing where I just need to achieve something. Mm. Even like, so, you know, when I'm hungover, I like to cook.
Yeah, I don't understand. I'm like, let's just get Uber Eats. You're like, absolutely not.
Yeah, because I think it's more that idea of being able to achieve something even when you cannot.
Just be useful in some way.
Yes, exactly. So, work has always been really important to me. A lot more in the last 5 or 6 years. It's become pretty much my main thing in life.
Mm.
Yeah. But I really enjoy it. Mm. Like, I really enjoy what I do. So I don't find it annoying. I don't find it stressful. I just love it. Like recently I've taken on a new role at my restaurant where I'm standing on the front as kind of the maitre d', the person who organises where everyone sits and things like that. And I didn't have to do that, but okay, so I'm standing there for like 19 hours. No, that's ridiculous. It's not 19. It's like 8 hours. But my feet are killing me. But by the end of it, I'm like, oh my God, that was so good because I was able to do so much today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so work has always been so important. And that definitely comes from my parents.
What did you think there, you know, when you reflect back as well on how hard they did work, and obviously that's had such a massive impact on who you are now, but I guess their resilience as well and their tenacity and their determination to set up a better life for their family, when you look back at that, what's that taught you about life?
All that's, like, when I think of, like, how hard Mum and Dad pushed and fought to be in Australia to give us a better life, I'm just so thankful for it. Like, I would have known nothing different. I might not have been born, which is just another thing, just because mum and dad were not allowed to see each other. Dad was like 8 years older. It was a communist country. Like, all of that stuff was just kind of like a no-no for their family. So that's why, partially why they ran. They left Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They wanted to live together. They wanted a family. It's kind of like, I was actually going to get another tattoo yesterday, and it was going to be, what's the worst that could happen? And that kind of comes back to them. It's like, no matter what I do or what situations I come up with, I don't think it's ever going to compare to what mum and dad had to deal with.
Yep.
So I'm like, literally, in any situation, what is the worst that could actually happen? Like, will I die? Am I going to get severely hurt? Like, what could actually happen? Yep. Like, break it down to that one moment where if one thing doesn't go right for you, what is the actual worst thing that could happen at this point?
Does that motto kind of carry through to everything now?
Yeah. Like, literally everything. Like, like, we've been friends for a very long time, and you know that, like, there are times when I get very, like, I get driven by emotion. But I feel as though in the last couple of years, I've gotten better at that. Mm. And I think that comes back down to that where I think, hey, in this moment, I might not be happy, but what is the worst thing that could happen at this point? Oh, is it really that bad?
Mm.
No. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of like, deal with it and let it go.
That's amazing that it's kind of come from watching all what they've been through, and not even watching, because a lot of it you weren't there for, but knowing what they went through as well has influenced that.
Definitely, 100%. Like, my parents are such a vital part of my life. Like, and it's really weird that I think you would feel the same. Like, as a teenager, you don't really care. And then, like, the older you get, the more that you're appreciative of your family and where that, what they've done for you and where they've come from.
Yeah, it's not until you're an adult and you realize that a lot of the things they are doing now, like they did, sorry, at that time of their life, you're now that age, and you're like, oh, I'm like, can't even, like, I'm trying to order an Uber Eats order, and you were like married with two kids by this age.
I know, like, I think about this all the time. Like, at this, at my age, Dad got on a boat and sailed for days with no idea where he was going.
Oh my God.
With like 20 strangers with all of his belongings on him. Like, that is ridiculous. Like,
and left his family behind, I assume.
Exactly, yeah, left his family behind. Like, his boat got attacked by pirates because of this is not even a lie. I know it sounds ridiculous. Like, I'm really sorry that this sounds so stupid. But, like, okay, so Dad's boat was attacked by pirates because pirates do this thing where they target refugee boats because all of their belongings are with them. So it means they'll be like, if they had any gold, it would be with them. If they had any money, so any jewelry, it's with them. So Dad's boat was attacked by pirates. Someone got shot and he died. Like, motors broke down and, like, motors had to be changed during, like in the middle of the ocean. Like, crazy things like that. Wow. And I'm just like, oh, cool. What's the hardest thing I've done? I lost MasterChef twice.
Calm down.
Real, they were big events though. Let's not diminish that.
Yeah, but it's not the same as, like, oh, changing a propeller when there's sharks around you. Like, that's frightening.
Literally,
like,
pirates ransacking the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh. Well, yeah, what's the worst can happen?
What's the worst that could really happen?
When you settled into Australia with your family, I know you were very young. Were there any struggles or anything that you noticed with settling in, or did you kind of just take it, you know, as a young kid does and just go about life as normal?
So we lived in Springvale, which is a very Vietnamese Australian community, has a very large Vietnamese community there. So the school that I went to was very Vietnamese. Mm. So I didn't feel different because everyone around me looked like me. Yeah. They were Vietnamese. Yeah. We were all Asian. It wasn't until high school that I started to be like, oh my God, I'm like totally different. I went from Haileybury, full Vietnamese community, to South St. Joseph, to Haileybury, which was majority Caucasian.
Mm.
Like, majority Caucasian. They did things that I didn't even really know about. Like, I didn't really know about, like, football and things like that. Like, yeah. I did, but it wasn't really a big part of my life. But there, it's like the sport culture was so huge at the school. And then the school was amazing because it opened my eyes to, like, different types of arts programs, music programs, drama programs. But that's when I started to kind of feel like I was different. And obviously I was gay at the time and I didn't really think about it back then because I'm like, oh, yeah, this is normal. And then I went to, like, high school and I was like, oh, no, people are bagging me because I'm like feminine and, like, but it was never that bad.
Yeah.
Like, I do you know what I mean? But I also think that maybe that's another resilience thing where I think if you don't choose for things to be that bad, it doesn't become that bad.
Mm.
And I feel as though even though there was a little bit of joking around and bullying happening, it was kind of like if I took control of that, then yeah.
Yeah. You've become such an incredible inspiration for so many in the gay community. Because you embrace who you are and you, you know, you help people through that. I know you've received such beautiful messages from people about, you know, watching them, watching you be who you are has made them accept who they are.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel when you think back to that boy that you just said that was at school kind of being bagged a little bit for being different?
I'm really happy to be able to do anything that I can. I feel as though, even though the LGBTQIA plus community has had a lot of acceptance in the last couple of years and a lot of understanding, there's still a little bit more to go. And it's little things. It's changing the way that people interact. An example is I have friends that speak to me with a different tone in their voice and speak to our straight mates. But it's not like, it's not condescending. It's not, they're trying to interact with me. But at the same time, I've called a few of them out on it, not everyone, because sometimes it's not that big of an issue. But sometimes I'm just like, why do you treat me different than our straight friends? But it's not, it's like, it's just like a little twang in their voice. So it's like, oh, hey, hon, kind of thing. Like, but they would never say that to any of the other boys. And I'm just kind of like, it kind of makes me feel less human.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that there's a lot to go there. And obviously anything I can do to help would be, like, incredible. That's why I'm in love with Minus 18. It's a charity that I support heavily. We all of the kind of You Are Love label clothes and apparel and all of those things, portions of the sales go to them because they do amazing work. They help youth in the LGBTQI plus community kind of through that whole early teenage years.
What was, so you said that there was a little bit at school, there was a little bit of teasing or you did feel a little bit different. Mm. Did it ever get that bad or did you, you know, what do you remember from that time?
It didn't really get bad until Halebury was never that bad. I went to Melbourne High for a year and that's kind of when it got a little bit more intense because at that point it became an all-boys school, whereas Halebury was parallel education. So it was male-females on the playground together, in classroom separate. So Melbourne High I hated. Like I hated it. Which is kind of really sad because it's a really good school.
Yeah.
But I hated going every day. I took the train in. It took me 50 minutes every day, out every day. I would come home upset all the time. And Mum was like, what do we do? And I was like, I want to go back. Like, I literally want to go back to Halebury. Mm. And at that point, we were doing well. But a saving of 20 grand a year is epic. Like, it's huge. I think a saving of 20 grand ever in your life a year is huge. Mm. So Mum basically said to me, like, we would really like you to stay because the education, apparently, like, in the Asian community at Melbourne High is, like, the epitome of, like, the best education you could ever have. Disagree. Wholeheartedly disagree. I think that the best education you can ever have is anywhere that you feel comfortable to learn. So Mum said to me, if you wanted to go back, you would need a scholarship or to make the fees cost the same. And so I applied for General Excellence Scholarship and I got 50% off. And then I took it to Mum and she goes, well, there's still another 10 grand that's just sitting there. And I was like, okay. So I applied for an academic scholarship and did the exam for it and luckily got it. And so I got to come back to Halebury. And that was, I think I would be such a different person if I did not go back to Halebury. Like, if my schooling wasn't at a school that was so accepting and that was so nurturing of everything that I was, then I would have had a total different life. I remember, like, I wanted to be a designer. And when I wanted to study fabrics, there was no male class. So what they did was move my timetable around so that one class I could be in a female class so that I could just do the subject. And I am like, that is just so good. Like, it's so progressive. Like, yeah. It's just so progressive.
So when you think back to your time at Melbourne High and think back to that era in life, does it help you identify with people who, in the gay community, who do feel isolated or alone or don't feel accepted for who they are?
Yeah, 100%. And I feel as though that whole isolation and being alone and not accepted actually would all, like, it continued to kind of be a common theme in my life all the way up until I was like 24, 25. Mm. Look, a part of it is still there now. I think it's like you grow up, like, it is a so, like, I hate it. Like, I hate it so much when we talk about, like, things affecting you as a teenager and, like, molding your life now. But I think it's very true. Mm. Like, obviously, I always fought to kind of, like, hide the differences, and there was always, like, self-confidence issues there, even though I am a very confident person. Mm-hmm. And I think it still has bled through to now. Like, there are times when I'm still kind of like, oh my God, I'm a fraud.
Yeah. Feeling like that imposter syndrome, or just feeling like you're not really, I don't know, like, is it not really deserving of what you've got? Is it that feeling?
It's kind of like feeling like, oh my God, is everything that I've done in my life a lie? And that, like, it's for somehow I've gotten to a point where I'm very, very lucky, but was it all, like, is it all not real? And that, like, one day someone's going to be like, hey, you're not gay, or you don't cook food, or you, like, it's just ridiculous.
Well, we stuffed this up. Sorry, give that back.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, oh no, okay, go back to being a DJ, like, be sad every weekend. I'm like, okay.
What do you hope people who are in the LGBTQI community get out of you sharing your story?
I just want to be some sort of representation. I feel as though when I was younger, there was really not a person of colour who was part of the community on TV or in the media. And I just feel as though, like, one person's not enough. Like, me being the token Asian gay person on TV is just not enough. Like, I feel as though, like, there has to be more of us, because, like, it doesn't make sense for the percentage to be, like, two people out of, like, hundreds of people on national TV. Like, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. And I just feel as though, and, like, that's still needed. And so I really want to work towards, like, doing more in the community. I feel as though it's all the things that I never thought I would do that is now happening. It's kind of like when I was growing up, I'm like, I'm never going to, like, be this voice for queer kids or queer people. I never thought that. I was like, someone else is going to do it. But then I'm like, no one else is doing it. Like, it's just kind of like, and then I've kind of, like, found myself in a very fortunate situation where I do have a platform, and, like, who else am I going to have, like, look out for? Like, I'm going to look out for my community, my people.
Do you think that you never thought that you would be doing it because you didn't see it? It didn't exist?
Yeah, I think so. Because I was always like, who does this? Mm. Like, who's the person that is actually, like, talking about, like, diversity, talking about how hard it is to grow up as a queer child? Like, I just, it's, you see it in on movies, but you don't see it in real life. Mm. Yeah, so I've found myself really fortunate that I'm at a place now where brands are willing to let me have that point of view and are happy to let me speak and just be myself. And and it's happened in even the last 2 years, 3 years, where the way that I write, the way that I interact with people, the way that everything that I do, I'm more comfortable with. I'm like, to a point, even though I was open and gay and out and I was proud, there was always a little bit of me that was like, hey, if we just do it at this a little tiny bit less gay, it'll work out better for you. Now I'm like, don't care. Like, I don't care. I'm pretty sure that, like, my Instagram is the most candid place that you would, like, find, like, ever. Like, my stories are literally about, like, bottoming and, like, having to douche and how much work it is. And it's like, and yet still brands are happy to work with me, because I'm like, it's, why are we not talking about this? Like, it's a very fundamental part of being a homosexual. Like, your prep.
So so true. When there would be so many young men and males and females who were you once upon a time, a teenagers who were feeling unsure or feeling scared or feeling like they might be not accepted or rejected. What do you hope that they, you know, they do look at your Instagram or they do look at the work you do. Do you hope that they see that there's a place for them?
That's definitely, I really hope that they do see that there's a place for them. I also hope that they understand that the things that make them different are literally the things that make them beautiful and special and celebrated. It took me a long time to realize that, and it's such a cliche because people used to tell you that when you were younger, when I was younger, that like your uniqueness is what makes you amazing. But now I totally understand it. Like being different is the reason that you will succeed in life. Mm. And so celebrate those differences, because I tried to hide them away for so long. And like, it wasn't until I celebrated them that I actually started to do better and was happier with myself.
Yeah. Wow. That's so profound, isn't it? Like when you look at it like that.
I know, but it's like, it's so annoying because I'm like, if I said that to myself, I'd be like, you're a dickhead. Like you're a liar and you're a dickhead.
Yeah, if you said that to 14-year-old Khan, what would he have said?
No, he would have just been like, of course you're going to say that. Like you're on TV and like, you're like out and proud. Like I'm just like this guy in the corner of the room. But I'm like, no, but you like the earlier you get that into your head, the better your life will be. Like I'm telling you that now and just listen to it.
Totally. There are so many mums that listen to this podcast. If their child was to come to them and tell them that they feel like they identify as LGBTQI, mm-hmm. I feel like, I hope I didn't leave a letter out there.
No, okay, so this is the thing. I always have conversations about this with like different parts of like organizations that are in the LGBTQIA plus community.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. But like people stop at T, people stop at Q, yeah. People stop at I. And I was like, I just run through the whole thing.
Whole alphabet.
Yeah.
I have seen a lot of amazing jokes about that. It's like how many more from that community being like, how many more letters can we add to this?
Just add a plus to the end and you're covered.
Yeah.
You're definitely covered.
So true. Well, if there are, if someone was to come to their parents and tell them that they feel like they are identifying as gay or bisexual or any of those letters, what advice would you have for mums listening to embrace their child and make sure that they know that there's, you know, it's almost...
I think it's not even just about the acceptance. Like, I feel as though, like, everyone's very accepting these days, but make a conscious effort to maybe learn about whatever your child identifies as. If they're gay, maybe do some research. If they identify as being trans, do some research with them, learn with them, because they may be really scared. Coming out to you as a parent would have been very, very difficult. It would have been one of those decisions that would have taken them years to kind of get around to even being brave enough to speak about. So your reaction isn't as important. Like, it is important, but I feel as though what happens after that initial reaction is really, really important. The support that is shown, not through just words, but like even being, send them annoying articles. Like send, like, so get pamphlets, get books that are annoying as F for the child, but at least they then know that you are willing to learn and you're willing to kind of care and support. It's not just about saying that you support. It's like, be that annoying mum or dad. Like,
be interested.
Be interested. Like, we just be willing to learn about it.
Yeah, totally. Mm. Do you remember what it was like when you came out to your family?
So I came out to my sister first and she was like, lol, duh. But in her, like straight face way where I just think that she hates me. And then it took me about 2 years after to actually come out to mum, and she was kind of just like, it was really ridiculously funny because I thought it was going to be this massive deal and she's like, oh, whatever. Like, who cares? She's like, anyway, like, if you want to be famous in Vietnam, this is great because LGBTQI plus are trending in Vietnam. And I was like, what are you talking about, mum? And she's just like, no, it's fine. Do you want to go to Vietnam? I was like, what are you even talking about? Like, this is the most ridiculous thing. She was just kind of like, how are we going to make this work for you? And I was
That doesn't sound familiar at all.
That's probably where I get it from.
I feel like we're joining the dots. We're piecing it together now. That is unusual, though, because I know when there's communities of Asian descent or any kind of in Australia, being gay isn't usually an accepted thing in those communities.
Yeah, look, I think my kind of experience with Vietnamese community, the Asian culture itself, has been very different to a lot of people. Mum and Dad, even before he... So Dad passed away when I was 16. I don't know if people know that. I'm just going to say that there. I was like, I don't know where else to put that in. Let's just do that there. Just so that everyone's like, why doesn't he talk about his father? Yeah. Like, yeah, so they were both really supportive of kind of all my decisions in my life. Like, I made dumb ones where I was just like, I'm going to be a plastic surgeon. And they loved that. Loved it to pieces. Like, they're like, yep, cool. So I was like doing biology, psychology, chemistry, all of it to get myself there. Halfway through, like in year 11, I was like, nope, want to be a designer. Mum was like, yeah, cool. Like, whatever. It, like, paid for me to go to classes after school. So I went to kind of like a Melbourne School of Fashion, 2 days a week, 3 hours a day to learn how to pattern make and construct garments and design and all of that stuff. So they've always been really supportive of every step that I've ever taken. Yep. Even when I became a DJ, like, who wants their child to become a DJ? Like, it's like, all right, cool, you're going to be drunk every weekend, you're not going to know anything, and you're probably going to be really sad in 30 years. Yeah, like
hooking up with lots of boys.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Mum would not want that. Like, yeah, but Mum was really happy. She was, even my tattoos, it takes Mum a little bit of time, but she gets things. Like, and it's things that I don't expect her to understand. Like, literally my first tattoo she hated, and then like three tattoos in she goes, I get what's going on.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? And she's like, no, I get it. Like, it looks good. I'm like, okay. So she's been really supportive of everything that I've ever wanted to do. So it's a little bit different, and I'm again very lucky to have that. But I feel like that's also a little bit of conditioning where I am very open with the way I speak. If I have issues, I usually speak about them. Even about this podcast. Side story. So
I knew we'd do this.
About a year ago, Elizabeth asked me to go on this podcast, and I said to her, hey babe, let's wait until after MasterChef second round, because I knew that I was going on MasterChef again. Anyway, she'll tell her side of the story in a sec. I didn't get asked to come back on. And then on my birthday about a month ago, I was like, babe, I'm actually really offended that you haven't asked me to come back on Lemonade. And she basically said to me, what?
I thought you didn't want to. So, yeah, this is what happened on March. So I asked him and I just was like, you know when you just get a feeling you're like, oh, I don't think that person really wants to. And I was like, oh, I think because he said the MasterChef thing, I was like, I think he's trying to like buy time and try and like make sure I kind of forget about it. So that was my thinking. So I was like, oh, I don't think Khan just wants to be on it. Okay, I'll just leave that. Yeah, and then it wasn't until a few weeks ago, a month ago, he was like, I've been so pissed at you all year because you didn't ever ask me. I'm like, I didn't think you wanted to be on. And it was just this incredible moment, I think, where you realize how easy it is to completely misconstrue someone else's intention with your own story.
Yeah, 100%. That's how I'm like, it's really important to just have conversations and be open. Because I do it all the time. Like, I'm the mediator in our house. When Mum and Amy have an argument, they both call me and I literally go, put me on loudspeaker or put me on three where we're doing this right now. It's like, Amy, how do you feel? And she's like, Mum made me feel sad because of this reason. And then Mum's like, that's not what I did. I'm like, yes, but she feels sad. So that's how she feels. And you can't tell her that she's wrong for doing so. So can you just take this on? And then Amy's like, I'm like, are you okay now? She goes, yeah. I'm like, do we have anything else to speak about? And she goes, no.
And then you're like, okay, done. All right, yeah. I've got to go.
But that's literally how I like to deal with situations. Like, I don't love confrontation, but I don't hate it.
Yeah.
Like, I think that, like, most of the time, all you need to do is speak about something or speak about an issue or bring it up, anything, ask for something. You're probably going to get what you want from it. It's just that people make these scenarios in their head where they're like, oh, my God, this is going to blow up to be a thing. But it never does. It's always like, okay, this is how I feel, this is how you feel, we understand each other, cool.
It's the stories we tell ourselves, we tell ourselves to give ourselves meaning and purpose and narrative that are usually just so far from reality.
Like, I legitimately, in my head, am dating four guys. Like,
me too.
And I'm like, am I dating any of them? No.
Do they know I exist? No. Oh, they probably know you exist.
Okay, one of them doesn't know I exist, but in my head, I'm dating Ricky Martin.
Oh, you guys are the cutest couple as well.
No, we had children together.
Oh, they're the cutest kids.
He sings, I cook.
Oh, it's just a perfect, perfect relationship. I'm so happy for you both. I don't know where to go from that question, by the way. I've got all these scripted questions in front of me. I reckon I've asked like two of them.
Oh, yeah, because I ramble. I'm a rambler. I'm really sorry.
No, it works so, it flows so much better like this. I love it. I'm just like, now I don't know where to go to all from you being married with kids with Ricky Martin to, did you experience racism when you were in Australia? Like, I'm like, I don't know how to segue to this, so.
We can definitely do the racism question. Racism always came in the form of, like, lol, you're eating fried rice.
Oh, like, and now everyone's like, hey, can I come to your restaurant and have some of your fried rice?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, like, I think when you're growing up, I'm in high school, I used to be so, so, like, self-conscious about the food that mum would give us as children. I'm like, can I just have a Vegemite sandwich? And mum's like, no, here's some fried rice with, I don't know, lemongrass chicken. And I'm like, yum, now. But, like, at the time, I'm like, oh, my God, this stinks. Like, everyone's going to be like, this is gross. And, like, and I used to get bagged for it. Like, I used to, there's one, it's really weird why when one thing affects you and stays in your mind. There was a girl in year seven that basically said to someone, and I was there, oh, I know Khan. He's the one that always eats spring rolls. And I'm like, And, like, it's that one thing that has been ingrained in my brain, and she wouldn't have even meant anything by it.
And maybe she did see you eat spring rolls once.
Exactly. But
that just sounds so racist.
Wait, segue from spring roll. Do you remember at 7? No, maybe you weren't there. But there was one night at 7 when someone called me a spring roll and I launched at them.
I think I do remember that.
Yeah.
No, like, I think I feel like I was there.
Someone called me a spring roll as a way of bagging me.
Yeah, they were being rude. I don't remember who it was or anything.
Yeah, it was at the door. He couldn't get in. And I was inside and I was DJing. So I walked in. And then he said something, blah, 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 spring roll. And I turned around and was like, what did you call me? And he goes, blah, 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 blah. And so I launched at him. And then I remember the security like, holding on to me and being like, please go upstairs.
Your set starting in 5 minutes. Please go.
My set's not for 2 hours. Let me punch this guy.
but you know, we are laughing and making joke of it. But that was recently.
It's racism still. Yes. It was probably what? And by recent, we mean like 10 years ago. But it was still in the 21st century.
Yes, like, totally. It's not like it was, exactly in the 1950s.
Yeah.
Not that you were alive then.
Yeah. Wow. Old.
Well, you know, I feel like you'd never age, so.
That's because I keep changing my age. Yes. I'm 25 again.
Oh, me too. I'm 25 as well. That is an interesting discussion to have, I think, because the discussion right now is so prevalent of, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and we wanting to amplify the voices of people of colour. And you mentioned that before as well. Why is it so important to see people from all different backgrounds on our television screens and doing all kinds of different jobs as well?
Because there needs to be representation for the younger generation coming up. Like, Australia is supposed to be very multicultural, which means the people living here are of all different races, all different cultures. That needs to be reflected on our screens.
Mm.
That representation is really important. It shouldn't be 5%. Mm. It should be exactly how big the percentage is in the real life Australia.
There was, I wish I did my research. There were stats that came out very recently. It was something like less than 5% of people on TV.
Which is like absolutely ridiculous. Mm. Like, I'm like, there's definitely more than 5% of Asian people in Australia. Like, I'm like, I probably know 5% of Asian people in Australia. Like, anyway.
There was a really profound moment in MasterChef, and I feel like I'm jumping from many different topics, so I hope you're all keeping up. But in MasterChef this year when it was every single one of the finalists, or everyone's single one of you in a competition were Asian.
Every one of us in the immunity challenge were Asian. MasterChef has been a program that has always had representation. Mm. We are not a category to them. We are not a token that they need to it's not a space that they just need to fill. Food has always been the forefront of MasterChef. And I genuinely believe that. They care about how you cook. They don't care about who you are. They don't care about your skin color.
Mm.
So I'm really, really proud to be coming off a show that is all about diversity.
Mm.
Yeah, it's food. It's about food. And that's what I love about it. Like, it's just like, if I cooked a crap dish, I get eliminated.
Yeah.
It happens.
But it's also, I think, a big part of it is that all different backgrounds come with different stories and different cuisines and different ways of cooking. Exactly. Like, alienating one area of the community is just alienating our exposure to potentially beautiful food.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I'm, like, this makes no sense as well. I'm obsessed with Greek food, like, obsessed with the way that, like, because it's so, the cooking style is just so minimal and it's the complete opposite to what I know from Southeast Asian cuisine, where we have like 35 ingredients that go into a paste. It was like ridiculous. I'm working on spices paste right now, and I'm like, oh yeah, so this green curry paste has like literally 22 ingredients in it. Like, wow. But it's like, it's all herbs and it's all things that help balance. And like, you can probably achieve a green curry using like 7 things, but it's that balance of like the other spices and the other herbs that kind of make it special.
Yeah.
But like, without MasterChef, I wouldn't have probably learned about how to cook Greek food or Middle Eastern food. Like, it's, we all learn off it, and I learn off the contestants, but I also learn off the show. Like, I'll see things and I'll be like, what is that dish? Like, I didn't even know biryani was a thing until like 5 years ago.
Oh my gosh, I love biryani. It's so
yum.
Good. Okay, sorry guys. We both just kind of stopped and just like stared into the distance as well. Like, I've never done a podcast like this where I literally just stopped when we spoke about a food and just like stared off in the distance thinking about it. Okay. I love that this episode is a Christmas week episode. This is just the perfect timing. Like, I just feel so good already. I feel like this is the perfect one for it.
Now, I'm going to leave part one of my conversation with Khan there, but never fear, you won't have to wait long. Part two will drop on Wednesday, and trust me, it is well worth the wait. If you'd like to follow Khan and see what he's up to, I've put the links in the show notes. As always, you can follow me at Elizabeth Anil. If you're loving Lemonade, I say it every week, but I'd be so appreciative if you could hit subscribe, hit 5 stars, leave a positive review, and even share this chat or any chat that you enjoyed on your social media and tag me. It really helps get the podcast out there, and perhaps will mean some other people who really need this kind of content will find Lemonade. Part two of my chat with Khan will drop on Wednesday. Chat to you then. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.